This is Norm Diamond. In our very first episode of Another World is Possible, long ago, we looked at an amusing short story by Louisa May Alcott about an effort to establish a utopian community in the mid-19th century United States. It was a way to talk about the relationship between idealism and practicality, vision and skepticism that underlies so much of our response to utopia. The story, Transcendental Wild Oats, also brought out the gendered nature of much utopian imagining. Some of the fun of the story came from the contrast between the highfalutin speechifying of the men and the day-to-day decisions and actions that had to be made by the women. But it's not obvious to most people in most times that there are alternatives, that another world is possible. In the next episode, we look deeper into that time period, exploring the social and economic developments that enabled people then to recognize that a fundamentally different organization of society was indeed possible. Politically, we contrasted mere outrage, which of course presupposes that something better could happen, with the recognition that change at the roots could make things vastly better. One topical example we cited was the difference between advocating for better training or more restraints on the police in our own times, on the one hand, or the actions that would follow from realizing that policing itself would be basically different in a society founded on racial and economic equity, available social services, meaningful work for all, and fully democratic control. We are surrounded by a culture that encourages a sense of determinism and inevitability, that the social and economic arrangements that exist are the only ones that could exist, that all history has led to where we are now and could have led nowhere else. Our work, our TV watching, internet browsing, sports spectatorship, are structured in ways that make it increasingly difficult to imagine significant alternatives. Really, to make a difference, we have to change that sense of possibility. Part of the answer of what enabled utopian dreaming in Louisa May Alcott's time was the social disruption caused by the expansion of market relations. One aspect of this was the creation of America's first industrial proletariat, not immigrant male workers, but young women from farm families, meeting new family needs for hard cash in what had been more of a subsistence economy. But what became of these young women, initially housed decently with chaperones, schooling, and cultural events, quickly turned utopian dreaming into dystopian reality. Writing very shortly after the experience about which Louisa May Alcott wrote, Herman Melville, author of Moby Dick, already was warning his readers both about the tyranny of machines and about the health and spiritual consequences for these young women. His story, The Tartarus of Maids, describes a visit to a paper mill. Tartarus, in Greek mythology, refers to the deepest depths of hell. Maids, in the language of Melville's time, were unmarried women. So, The Tartarus of Maids. Patricia Kohlberg will read some passages. Here's the story's protagonist, his first impression.
Not a syllable was breathed. Nothing was heard but the low, steady, overruling hum of the iron animals. The human voice was banished from the spot. Machinery, that vaunted slave of humanity, here stood menially served by human beings, who served mutely and cringingly as the slave serves the sultan. The girls did not so much seem accessory wheels to the general machinery as mere cogs to the wheels.
The first-person narrator requests a tour.
He took me up a wet and rickety stair to a great light room furnished with no visible thing but rude, manger-like receptacles running all round its sides, and up to these mangers, like so many mares haltered to the rack, stood rows of girls. The air swam with the fine, poisonous particles which from all sides darted subtly as motes in sunbeams into the lungs. "This is the rag room," coughed the boy. "You find it rather stifling here," coughed I in answer, "but the girls don't cough." "Oh, they are used to it."
The flying machinery into which the workers insert their hands remind him of weapons.
"The edges of those swords, they are turned outward from the girls, if I see right, but their rags and fingers fly so, I cannot distinctly see." "Turned outward?" "Yes," I murmured to myself, "I see it now. Turned outward, and each erected sword is so borne edge outward before each girl. If my reading fails me not, just so of old, condemned state prisoners went from the hall of judgment to their doom. An officer before bearing a sword, its edge turned outward in significance of their fatal sentence. So, through consumptive pallors of this blank, raggy life, go these white girls to death. Those sides look very sharp," again turning toward the boy. "Yes, they have to keep them so. Look." That moment, two of the girls, dropping their rags, plied each a whetstone up and down the sword blade. My unaccustomed blood curdled at the sharp shriek of the tormented steel. Their own executioners, themselves wetting the very swords that slay them, meditated I.
And finally, about the threat posed by this new kind of industrial enterprise, and about its workers.
Something of awe now stole over me as I gazed upon this inflexible iron animal. Always, more or less, machinery of this ponderous, elaborate sort strikes, in some moods, strange dread into the human heart, as some living, panting behemoth might. But what made the thing I saw so specially terrible to me was the metallic necessity, the unbudging fatality which governed it, though here and there I could not follow the thin, gauzy veil of pulp in the course of its more mysterious or entirely invisible advance, yet it was indubitable that, at those points where it eluded me, it still marched on in unvarying docility to the autocratic cunning of the machine. A fascination fastened on me. I stood spellbound and wandering in my soul. Before my eyes, there, passing in slow procession along the wheeling cylinders, I seemed to see, glued to the pallid incipience of the pulp, the yet more pallid faces of all the pallid girls I had eyed that heavy day. Slowly, mournfully, beseechingly, yet unresistingly, they gleamed along, their agony dimly outlined on the imperfect paper, like the print of the tormented face on the handkerchief of Saint Veronica.
There's a complex relationship between utopia and dystopia, those supposedly opposite, but really closely linked ways of understanding the world and its possibilities. Melville was writing a warning, not settling for what he saw happening around him. His stance was that things don't need to develop the way they are going, that another direction was possible. We'll continue to explore the relationship between utopian and dystopian visions here, on another world, is possible. This has been Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.